back to it in the fifth essay, which we'll look at. But at some point in the middle of the book, he kind of abandons, I would think, what we would call the quest for philosophy. And now he decides that he's less interested in refuting that which he regards as false, and is more interested in describing what he regards as true. Meaning, philosophy often is involved in showing you why something else is wrong. And Rav Yehuda Halevi kind of lost interest in that, which, you know, one can understand, because he says, let's stop dealing with the refutation of Sheker, and let's talk about the concepts of Emes. And that's why, in a sense, the Kuzari is, again, I don't mean this in a negative way, but it is a strange book in many ways, because it is not, absolutely not, a classic philosophical work, even as the Moreh Nevuchim or the Sefer Yikarim is, but rather it's an exposition of Judaism from the perspective of a great teacher. So the point in which we're up to is he discusses the need of Shabbat, the specialness and the uniqueness of Shabbat and the holidays, and he gives a very poetic description of the fact that a person is often beaten down in the course of the week. In particular, if you imagine Jews who lived in poverty, and how there's no time to think about God and no time to absorb spirituality. And then comes the special days in which one can remove themselves from all of that which would beat them down. And that, of course, is the idea of Shabbat, and where every Jew, every Jewish man becomes a king, as it were, every Jewish woman becomes a queen. And this is what enables the Jew, says Rav Yehuda Halevi, to survive the bitterness of the Galut and the persecution of the Galuts. Because they always knew that a Shabbat was right around the corner. Right? How does that bumper sticker go? What is a bumper sticker? Don't panic, it's almost Shabbos.
Oh,
it's
something
of that nature. And Rav Yehuda Halevi actually articulates this very, very clearly. Again, I don't remember, I may have mentioned this last time, but I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik having a recollection of the fact that in his when he grew up in Europe in a small town, So many of the Jewish people were porters. They would carry very heavy loads and water carriers, and they would be so totally bent over the entire week. And came Shabbat, and they were like kings and queens in their long kafatas and their long silk garments, and they literally looked as if they were different people. They were transformed. And this, of course, is even Achat Ha'am, the secular Zionist Jewish romantic thinker, had the famous saying that more than the Jews have kept the Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. In this sense, I want to share with you a later thought, and that is the Shabbat davening, the Shabbat prayers, are unique in a certain way that no other holiday shares. If you're familiar with the holiday liturgy, you know that for every Yom Tov, even Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we do have the identical prayer for Arvit, for the Mariv, for the Shacharit, for the morning, and for the Mincha. Musaf is different. But it's always the same Amidah. The Amidah is the same for evening, morning, and afternoon. The only exception in the entire Jewish calendar where you have a different intermediate blessing for the evening service, for the morning service, and for the afternoon service is the Shabbat davening. Because Friday nights, now again, the first three blessings and the last three blessings are the same, but that middle blessing, the singularity of Shabbat, differs from the evening to the morning to the afternoon. Friday night, the bracha is Atah Kidashta. It talks about God sanctifying the Shabbat and creating the world in 6 days. Shabbat morning, it talks about Moshe bringing down the Ten Commandments. And Mincha, you are one and your name is one. Three different introductory paragraphs. Now, the commentaries explain that the reason why we have three different introductory paragraphs for Shabbat is because this is a reference to three pivotal Shabbatot in Jewish destiny. Two of them are past and one of them is future. Shabbat number one is the Shabbat of creation. God created the world in 6 days. He rested on Shabbat. And Shabbat became holy because that was the day that God rested from his creative endeavors. That is the theme of the Friday night Amidah, which emphasizes the Shabbat as the Shabbat of creation. That's why we read by Yechulu that God had completed the world in 6 days and rested in Shabbat. So Friday night, Shabbat of creation. Now, the second pivotal Shabbat, it's relevant to this week's parsha, and that is, according to rabbinic tradition, it's not explicit in the Torah, God gave the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people on Shabbat. Matan Torah was on Shabbat. Therefore, the second aspect of Shabbat is revelation. And consequently, the theme of the Shabbat morning prayer talks about Moshe coming down with the Ten Commandments. That is the Shabbat of revelation. Although, I have to admit, it doesn't quite fit, because if it talks about Moshe coming down with the Ten Commandments, that was not on Shavuot. That was 40 days later, the first time, and then Yom Kippur the second time, but at least the reference to Matan Torah. So, Friday night, says the Torah, is the theme of theme of creation. Shabbat morning is the theme of revelation. Now, the third pivotal Shabbat is the Messianic Shabbat, which is not a single day, but the Yemot HaMashiach, the final redemption of the world, is referred to as Yom Shekulo Shabbat. It is the world of the eternal Shabbat, in which there will be tranquility, in which there will be peace, in which there will be Dveikut, there will be attachment and closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, the theme of the Shabbat Mincha Amida, which talks about the unity of God, that will not be realized until Yemot HaMashiach, when all of the nations of the world will recognize, right? V'hoya v'yomahu, yiyah Hashem Echad. That day, Hashem Echad, God will be one, and His name will be one. So, every Shabbat involves the affirmation and belief in these three ideas. The Shabbat of creation, the Shabbat of revelation, the Shabbat of redemption. And of course, let me remind you that this actually corresponds to Rav Yosef Albo, the Sefer HaKarim, who wrote that there are three fundamental principles that Jews have to believe in. One is that there is a God who created the world. That is the Shabbat of creation. Number two, God gave a Torah, the revelation of His will. That's the Shabbat of revelation. And number three, Schar V'Onesh. God rewards goodness and punishes evil, which is ultimately going to be realized in the Messianic era, because in this world we don't always see evil getting punished or righteous people getting rewarded. So in effect, Shabbat is a perpetual reaffirmation of the fundamental ideas of Judaism. And to give you a more modern analog, if you are familiar, this is not, of course, in modern Jewish philosophy, so to speak, but if you are familiar with Franz Rosenzweig's work, The Star of Redemption, he, in fact, predicates his entire philosophy on the three ideas of creation, revelation, and redemption. I mean, that is exactly his thing. And this is based, in large part, on the fundamental basis of the Shabbat prayers. Because Shabbat, after all, is described as an edut. Every Jew who observes the Shabbat gives testimony to the world regarding these fundamental ideas. But it's not just a general testimony, but it's focused very specifically on God as my creator, God as the one who reveals His will to me in the form of Torah and mitzvot, and the God in whom I place my faith as an ultimate redeemer who will reward all that is virtuous and will eventually punish that which is evil and degenerate. Now, if we take it a little further, though, it's an interesting point that one might say that the three tefillot of Shabbat are not merely philosophical affirmations of these three ideas, but they also represent transformations within an individual. That every Shabbat, we go through three stages. We go through being created, we go through an experience of revelation, we go through an experience of redemption. How does this work on an individual level? Well, the first thing that happens when Shabbat comes is a person can feel a sense of being reborn, right? A person has all of these chains around their neck, they feel weighted down, they feel oppressed. And Shabbat gives the person the ability to be reborn, to be recreated, to put aside those burdens. A very vivid, I remember reading in Herman Welk, you know, the novelist who, you know, lives in Georgetown some part of the year, in the Virgin Islands, the other part of the year. But Herman Welk wrote a book about his connection to Judaism. He's an Orthodox Jew. This is my God. It was one of the first books of that genre. Now there are quite a few. And he describes the fact that shortly after World War II, he was writing a play for Broadway. This was going to be his first Broadway play. And they were going to open up Saturday nights. So around 3 o'clock Friday afternoon, imagine what a Broadway play is like. I can't imagine it, but I could imagine it. It's Friday, and they're going to open up tomorrow night. People are going crazy. So he announces at 3 o'clock, well, got to go now. So the guy tells him, okay, just be back in 15 minutes. I figured, you know, he's going to the bathroom or getting a cup of coffee. He says, no, I got to go for a longer period. He says, how long, an hour? He says, no, I got to go, and I'll be back, you know, 15 minutes before opening time, you know, tomorrow night. I'll be here by the curtain. He says, are you crazy? You know, in 24 hours we're opening up, and you can just leave? And then he realized for the first time that that's one of the things that Shabbos says we can do. Yeah, Shabbos says we leave. Shabbat says no matter what is going on, we put it behind us. We free ourselves from the world that makes demands on us. So Shabbat, on one level, is this concept of absolute freedom, that a human being is not a slave to anyone other than God, to anything, that there's nothing short of human life itself that can make a demand on me that is beyond my need to refresh myself, to take control, to not be a slave, to not have to answer the phone. In fact, Norman Mailer, who's hardly, he happens to be Jewish, but he's hardly an observant Jew, but he had an abortive campaign for the mayor of New York in 1966, I think it was. When John Lindsay was mayor. And Norman Mailer wanted to propose what he would call a Super Sunday. That he was Sunday that on Sunday nobody would answer the phone, nobody would drive a car. You know, basically he was describing what a Shabbat is. You know. And the concept of being free. So Shabbat on that level, the most basic level of Shabbat, is the concept of freedom. That I am not a slave to other people. That a human being cannot be a beast of burden. A person needs time to think and needs time to reflect and needs time to be with their family and needs time to prioritize what is important in their lives. And when you have frenetic movements over and over and over and over again, that destroys the peace of mind that can enable a person to grow. So that's the level of Shabbat as being recreating. It's a rebirth. It's a liberation. That's why, by the way, I'll get to that later. Now, we then come to the Shabbat morning, and Shabbat morning gives us a necessary counterbalance. Because if all one sees in the Shabbat is freedom and liberation, but not yet coupled with a submission to the will of God, then it simply becomes an excuse to shirk responsibilities. It simply becomes, you know, I'll sleep all day, or I'll go to the beach, or I'll watch movies. So consequently, the concept that Shabbat gives me freedom, that's the Shabbat of creation. You are reborn, free of all those chains, has to be counterbalanced with the notion that Shabbat is a day of revelation. Revelation, of course, is the communication of God's will, meaning freedom is not an end in and of itself. Freedom is a condition that enables a person to focus and direct their energies to a higher and more worthy goal, and that is submission to the will of God. And therefore, you need a freedom, just like Pesach and Shavuot, it's the same relationship. Pesach is the exodus of Egypt. Shavuot is the holiday of Matan Torah, and the counting of the Omer is the linkage, the connecting point between freedom and submission. And that's actually in every Shabbat, creation and revelation. Because that's really the part of the malaise of American society, is that our society places such a premium on freedom from restraints that people are never given a positive sense of what life is about. What is the purpose of life? What do you do with your freedom? You know, in the olden days, when people had to, you know, kids had to work and then work in the farms and everything else, the issue of the aimlessness of what do you do with your time wasn't such a big issue. I mean, you were working, you know, hours and hours and hours. But ironically, freedom creates anxieties all of its own. A society where kids can do whatever they want, where, you know, every high school 10th grader gets a car or whatever it is, you know, people say, oh, they have it so easy. The truth is, it's not that easy. It creates a tremendous amount of anxieties. What is the purpose of life? What do I do with my money? What do I do with my freedom? What do I do? How do I live my life? What am I? And it's no accident that the tragedy of both teen suicides and the teenage violence that we've seen, is the amazing thing about shooting up kids in school, comes precisely in really one of the most affluent, maybe the most affluent society in history. Because when all the material needs are met, there's an emptiness and an aching void within a person for purpose and meaning. So if Shabbat gives us the message of freedom, it then must remind us to channel that freedom in purposive and positive ways. That's the Shabbat of revelation, Matan Torah. We then come to the very end of Shabbat, which is the Shabbat of redemption. Now, redemption, of course, is a national and collectivist phenomenon. The Jewish people will be redeemed, Moshiach, Tchiyat HaMeitim. But redemption is also an experience that individuals undergo, even within their own lives. Because galut, exile, is not merely a phenomenon of not being in the land. There is a galut that exists within a person. Galut is estrangement, alienation, loneliness, isolation. There is a galut, of course, between a person and his connection to God. There is galut, estrangement between human beings. And there is also estrangement within oneself, in which one is divided and polarized. Now we know that the characteristic of galut, at least the galut that we're in, is the galut of sinat chinam, hatred, polarization, dissension, division. And that division between Jew and Jew, whether it be religious and non-religious, or different types of religious and secular, whatever the whatever way you draw it, means that we're not united. And that also means we're separated from God, because when the Jewish people are not united, that also creates a separation. God's divine presence does not rest among us. And there's also fragmentation within ourselves, because we are pulled in many different ways. Our emotions might consume us with anger and envy and materialism and lust, whatever it might be. And our minds might know it's not right, but our minds and our hearts are not coordinated together. So when we talk about Atoy Echad, you God are one, this is from the Mincha service, V'shimcha Echad, your name is one, we talk about unity. The unity is that a unity between us, a unity between God and Israel, and a unity within the human being, so that the mind and the intellect and the emotions and the feelings all focus with harmony and unity and coordination. That is an experience of redemption. That is inner redemption. And when one achieves that inner redemption, one is ready for the outer redemption of coming to Eretz Yisrael, the Beit HaMikdash, the Moshiach. Because in truth, outer redemption, in many ways, is just a mirror of a process that must take place within the individual heart and soul. And until it takes place within the individual heart and soul, this is why Maimonides writes that until there's tshuva, there cannot be Mashiach. Until the redemption takes place within, it cannot take place outside. That's why, again, I mean, they're different versions. That's why we find, particularly in the Hasidic movements, this is all controversial historical area, in the later stages of the Hasidic movement, you found a de-emphasis, right? People say on political Zionism, right? Say, for example, people often say, why didn't the great rabbis of Europe encourage more Jews to make Aliyah before, during Hitler's rise to power? That would have saved lives. I mean, these are difficult questions. I'm not going to give an answer to those questions at all right now. Other than to say that in the Hasidic movements, and actually probably in the non-Hasidic movements as well, there was a sense that Eretz Yisrael, even the Beit HaMikdash, even Mashiach, are simply the external signs of an inner redemption that must take place within the individual. And therefore they emphasized the concept of the inner redemption over the external manifestations of the outer redemption. Now, Rav Yehuda HaLevi, presumably, doesn't necessarily go on that tack. Although, of course, he talks about the importance of inner redemption, but as you know, he has many, many strong statements about the affirmative obligation to go to the land of Israel, because in his view, the living in the land of Israel is not the consequence of the inner redemption, but it is a facilitator of that inner redemptive process. That by living in Israel, one gets in contact with one's higher self, and one becomes transformed. So some Hasidim took the position, well, when you achieve that high spiritual level, now you're ready to go to the land of Israel. Rav Yehuda Halevi would say, no, you go to Israel and that's how you get it. Right, so you see, these are different views regarding that particular process.
Because there's also this philosophy of doing it first and then you will...
Right, which we normally do say, right. We normally say that in mitzvot, certainly.
Right.
But Yehuda Halevi was very emphatic that applies to the land of Israel. But here, with this idea, therefore, that the Shabbat represents three experiences that we go through. The experience of being liberated. The experience of using our liberation in submission to the will of God. And then the experience of feeling a wholeness and an integration within ourselves. Of course, that happens around the Sudah Shlishit, around the third meal, the very end of Shabbat, which highlights the interesting idea that one is not really ready for Shabbat till Shabbat is almost over. Meaning to say, you need the Shabbat to be ready to absorb the redemption of Shabbat. Then, of course, it's too late. But this might be the famous explanation. There's a famous passage in the Talmud that says, if the Jewish people were to observe two Shabbatot in a row, they would be redeemed. Why do you need two Shabbatot in a row? The reason is because Shabbat number one gets you up to the state in which you're ready to experience redemption. So when you enter Shabbat number two, so to speak, now you can experience 24 hours of Shabbat on that heightened level. Now there's a popular Jewish song, Mordechai ben David, one of the sings, just one Shabbat and we'll all be free. Right? Just one. I won't sing it for you, but he says that since he composed that song in Israel, he was basing the song on a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud that says all they have to do is keep one Shabbat. But the Babylonian Talmud says they have to keep two Shabbatot. But I guess just two Shabbos doesn't have the same...
One Shabbat in Eretz Yisrael, maybe equals two.
Maybe, that might be it. Maybe Eretz Yisrael. Well, because they do say that one of the reasons why we have two days of the Yom Tov, huh?
That's nice. If you observe two Shabbatot, that's it. From now on, you don't have to observe.
No, the Mashiach comes. After Mashiach comes, you got to keep Shabbat too. It doesn't say you're off the hook, but it means you're in the Messianic era. But this, by the way, I just want to say that this explains a very, very interesting grammatical anomaly in the Shabbat davening, and maybe you've noticed it over the years. That is, in the Friday night davening, Shabbat is referred to as, in the feminine gender, it says, V'yanuchu va, Yisrael. They shall rest in her. Shabbat is called a her, a she. In the morning, Shabbat is referred to in the masculine gender, V'yanuchu vo. They shall rest in him, in it, but in him, if the masculine. And in Mincha, it is referred to in the plural. V'yanuchu vam. They shall rest in them, in the Shabbatot. There's a switch. Ba, bo, bam. Very problematical. Now, to be honest, now the truth is, in our Siddur, you will see this switch. To be honest, there are authors that have suggested that the concept of doing it three different ways is a mistake, that in fact, there were three different versions of the prayer, meaning those that said ba all three times. And those that said bo all three times. And those that said bum all three times. And the printers simply made a mistake, and they figured, well, they see three different versions, they'll put one down for Maariv, and one for Shacharit, and one for Mincha. In other words, according to that, it's fundamentally a mistake, it should be one or the other. But nevertheless...
My idea is that creation has something to do with the woman.
That's right.
It's birth to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Revelation is the father teaches the child.
Right.
And redemption when Klal Yisrael is together.
Well, you got it. That's exactly the point that we're making. If you go with these three dimensions, the imagery of Friday night is rebirth, to be reborn, to be recreated. So what is Shabbat? Shabbat is like our mother that gives birth to us, free of all those chains. Shabbat morning is the duty of submission, discipline, the teaching of Torah. which historically at least was always perceived as what a father does. The father, not only the father, but the father has a dominant role in that discipline and guidance. And Shabbat Mincha, which is redemption. Redemption is bringing it all together, bringing the discordant aspects of ourselves into one. So we talk about the plurality that gets united. So it's very, very true that in this grammatical discrepancy, one sees the idea of these multiple dimensions of what Shabbat represents. So once again, it's a very, very beautiful description. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi openly says that it is Shabbat and Yom Tov more than anything else, he says, that ensures the survival of the Jewish people.
Rabbi, doesn't your redemption depend on mine?
Sure.
Then, I don't exactly know how to phrase the question. Maybe you'll help me. I understand the first two Shabbatot.
Right.
The third one, though, doesn't seem as individual to me. Or it seems as though, unless everybody's doing it...
Well, I think you have to understand, though, that redemption is not a total on-off button. Meaning, it is very, very true. Complete, total redemption, even as an individual, can only occur when there's a collective redemption. Meaning, I can never be totally redeemed if there's another Jew who's not totally redeemed. But I can achieve something. I can achieve a taste. I can achieve an uplift. I can achieve a glimpse. And the glimpse can be stronger or weaker, depending on what I've done and the work and the investment I've put in to achieve that. So Shabbat is called Me'ein Olam Haba. Me'ein Olam Haba means a little resemblance of the world to come. So you're correct. We're not making the assertion that one can experience a total redemption every Shabbat.
Because of what happens afterwards.
That's correct. But one achieves a glimpse of what is possible in life. And one has to be open to it. Now again, this is also not an automatic process. You know, our big problem, and this is a problem with everyone, I mean, no matter, you know, the most religious, and the less, that's all of us have a problem. You know, we work schedules, and we come home Friday, and, you know, we have an hour to get ready, or whatever it is. And we rush into things. We don't give ourselves the time to prepare and to contemplate. Even Shabbat itself, you know, it's a funny thing with the davening. In a way, there are activities in Shabbat too, which although are very important, but in a way, the concept of the, particularly on a short Shabbat, the concepts of the, you know, the time that you need to marinate in the Shabbat is often not going to be there. Again, forgive me if I'm repeating myself because I don't remember what I said last week, but I remember in Eretz Yisrael when I was in Jerusalem, so I had noticed, you know, if you know the Kotel, everyone knows the Kotel is the big wall, but there's also, you know, the Kotel keeps on going, right? The wall keeps on going into the Arab neighborhoods. And there's a portion of the wall that's generally not open to the public, which is just in some Arab's backyard. And that's called the Kotel Katan. That's called the small wall, the small portion of the wall. And small groups of people do go there to pray. You know, it's away from the crowd. It's a much more intimate thing. The Kotel Katan, just further in.
You go under the arch.
But not under the arch. The arch itself is a big people down there, but it's past the arch. It's the other, it's all the way in the Muslim quarter.
On the men's side, you can extend
on the men's side, yeah. But you can't reach it from the tunnel. You have to go into the Arab quarter.
Oh.
So it's not the safest thing either. But I had seen a big sign that they were trying to organize a special program where every Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, even if Shabbat would not begin for another hour and a half or so, they would have a mincha minyan at the Kotel Katan. And then they would read the Song of Songs from a scroll, from a cloth. And then, you know, people would go to the mikveh, and people would be dressed in white, etc. It was a way of kind of getting into the spirit. After all, Shira Shirim is, of course, is a love song. But the love song is the love between God and the Jewish people, as well as its literal meaning. And that was the concept of, and, you know, Shira Shirim, Friday is an old custom. But the concept is that one should really get into the spirit. So the truth is, many things that we do are so attenuated, or so, you know, it's like, I'll tell you a story that's kind of reminiscent of this. The story goes that a father-in-law had two daughters that he married, two great rabbis, and he had promised to support the families for a few years as they were learning. So one, the deal that he made with the first son-in-law was, I'll give you a meat meal every day. Every day you'll get beef or chicken, steak. Well, that's what I'll give you. And the second one, he promised, every day he'll give him a very fancy dairy meal with cheese and blintzes and souffles and everything else. So the sons-in-law used to argue, who's considered to be more prestigious? One said, well, I'm prestigious, I get steak. And other said, well, I get fancy, actually kosher cheese could actually be more expensive than kosher meat, kosher meat per pound. Right. So, be it as it may, after a while though, the father-in-law got poor, and he could no longer afford meat or cheese. He only could afford potatoes and rice. So how did he fulfill his commitments? He said, well, I'll make you the rice in the fleishik pot, in the meat pot, and I'll make you the rice in the milchik pot. So, you know, so they got the same meal, but one got it in the fleishik pot. So they still continued to argue over, you know, who's considered to be more prestigious. So the father-in-law finally steps in and says, you know, when you were getting meat and you were getting, you know, milk, you know, you might have a machloket, you know. Now you're all getting potatoes, you know, who cares if it's in the fleshic pot or the milk pot? Well, some have said that sometimes our authentic experience of Judaism is really kind of something bland that just is cooked in the meat pot. It has a little taste of meat or a little taste of milk, but the real, real substance is just not as intense and not as comprehensive and not as full as it once was. And certainly for many of us, the Shabbat has become sucked out. The marrow has been sucked out. In fact, we have an issue. People say, what do you do? And I say it too sometimes. I mean, what do you do with the long, like Shabbat in the summer goes till 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. What do you do with the time? As opposed to looking at it as such a treasure and such an opportunity. And it just shows us that we just haven't always found the right orientation for sacred time and sacred moments. You know, we don't know what to do with it. The truth is, we don't know what to do with free time. I mean, that's 100% true. We like to be frenetic. I mean, we may say we don't like it, but it might be a dirty secret that, you know, when we're frenetic and when we're busy and when we have so much to do, it just keeps our mind off thinking about, you know, our lives and everything else. And sometimes it's easier not to go through that process. But the Torah says, you know, sorry, you're going to have to go through it. You have to go through it. You want to be a human being, you want to be a Jew, you've got to take that time off and figure out the process that you need, right? So it's not always the case that these are the easiest experiences for people. Sometimes they're not the easiest experiences, but God says we have to make them. We have to make them meaningful, right? So that's Rav Yehuda Halevi's excursus on Shabbat and Yom Tov, the concept of the royalty. And again, he makes the point. And again, for us who are living in affluence, we don't see it as much. But he describes it, and certainly I've seen it described in the European shtetl, for the Jew that was living in grinding poverty, what the Shabbat meant even psychologically is just beyond our comprehension.
One of the most beautiful scenes, I'm sure we've all seen it, the Fiddler on the Roof scene when Shabbat comes in and they bless the girls. And to me, there's always been such a beautiful manifestation of the terrible poverty and abuse all his life. And then suddenly the whole scene is glowing with the beauty and the splendor of Shabbat.
No, that's 100% correct. And even someone like, you know, Shalom Aleichem, who is not an observant person, Achad Ha'am, I mentioned, I mean, these were all people who just saw from their own lives as children what the transforming power of Shabbat was to the, you know, the dark and often, you know, often sad life of the Eastern European shtetl, which was so mired in poverty, truly beyond their comprehension. And, you know, I mean, there might be some poor people in America that are like that, go to Appalachia, whatever it is, but, you know, the average person that's defined as even a low income would be, you know, basically kind of middle-class Jew, or even upper-middle-class Jew in Poland.
I was in Poland sometimes, reading one of those magazines, and it was one of these women's magazines. It was written by a Jewish woman who described how wonderful Christmas Day was for her family because it was a time that she couldn't get together with any of her friends. All the stores were closed. They had to stay home. They had to do family things.
Right.
And it was such a sad article for me, because yes, we talk about the poverty, the physical poverty, but it's just such terrible spiritual poverty that Saturday is the day to take kids to soccer or to go grocery shopping.
Very true. And, you know, it is a big problem in Israel in particular time because, you know, Israel does have officially the 6-day work week. Israel's Sunday. In fact, one of the hard things if you live in Israel is to get used to Sunday. I kept on, when I would give a shiur in Israel, so whenever I would finish on Thursday, I would always say, "See you on Monday." Say, no, Sunday. You know, and the whole year I was like, "See you on Monday." But so you know, it's very hard. You know, Sunday, get up at 6:30. You know, do your regular schedule. But the truth of the matter is, if you think about it, for a non-religious person, Saturday therefore becomes literally the only day where there's any family time for an outing or for an excursion, because, you know, Sunday or Friday's a half day. But in a sense, one might say that the 6-day work week is preventing a number of Jews who would be more inclined, perhaps, to explore the quiet time in Shabbat.
Absolutely, because that's the time to have a soccer game.
But there's literally no other time. There's no other time.
No, but that's why. Yeah. Before it was economically required. They needed to work six days.
So there's a suggestion. There is a movement, a big movement in Israel. I mean, not for religious reasons only, but there's a big movement in Israel to go to a 5-day work week.
Of course, the way
some people describe it is,
they would take off,
you know,
Friday.
Israel's already on a 3-day work week, but okay. So this would be a double. Yeah.
I often find also that in terms of our relative wealth of past generations, that also gets in the way of really proper celebration of Shabbat in terms of the Shalosh Sudot. It's a mitzvah to eat Shalosh Sudot. If you have a guest for lunch and you're sitting at the table for hours and hours because you're enjoying each other's company and you're having Shabbat and all that, but that's the spirit. Oh my gosh, you guys, you should. And then you're not finished afterwards. It's a mitzvah to have the I'm telling you.
Jews like to eat.
But you see, we don't really have the right orientation.
The right priority. Well, you know, it is true. You know, Shabbat is described as giving a person neshama yetera, an extra soul. In fact, according to the tradition, the reason why we inhale spices at the end of Havdalah is because as we lose our extra soul, we become faint and weak, and we need smelling salts to revive us. That's exactly why you have besamim. So neshama yetera obviously means the heightened receptivity to ruchniyot, to spirituality. But there is a comment of Rashi that says that is why on Shabbat you can eat more, because you are eating for two. You have an extra soul. You have a capacity for eating and drinking. Of course, regrettably, the neshama yetera that leaves does not take the calories with it.
It leaves it
behind. But nevertheless, that is the neshama yetera. In fact, it's interesting. Now, there's a verse in Ecclesiastes in Kohelet that says, all the days of a poor person are bad. So the Talmud asks, well, Shabbat and Yom Tov is bad? That's when he gets to eat? He says, that's bad too, because if he starves the whole week and eats heavy food on Shabbat, he'll get sick. So it says, even on Shabbat and Yom Tov he suffers because, you know, he's eating beyond his capacity on those particular days. But again, it's something to think about. You know, even the concept, I'll give you even another example that's, a trivial example. It's very interesting. You know, in halacha, there was always a discussion of big day Shabbat, the special garments a person wears in Shabbat. There's even a discussion if a person is in mourning for his parents for the whole year, 12 months, do you wear big day Shabbat? Now, you know, so if the kid is in school, there is a concept of big day Shabbat, right? The way a kid dresses in school will not necessarily be the way they'll dress on Shabbat, although sometimes they do. But, you know, a person, let's say, goes to work every day, a person's a lawyer, wears a business suit. What is the concept of big day Shabbat? You know, one does not necessarily look any different. The concept of distinct, special garments that are only for Shabbat, that are not worn during the week, has been lost in many, many cases, you know. That sense of total differentiation, we simply don't have. Now, in Europe, there were people, for example, even if they wore a suit during the week, they would wear a short jacket, what we call a regular jacket, and on Shabbat they would wear like long.
A bekesha,
a long garment. But, you know, if you don't do that, so at least for men, maybe for women they may dress a little fancier, but, you know, men on Shabbat will typically wear, you know, what they would wear to the office, at least if they wear a suit to the office, you know. So
now we have dressed on Fridays, so we have that.
Ah, excellent, that's excellent. So the concept is to differentiate. It's just like we say, you know, when you blow the shofar during the month of Elul, you're not supposed to blow it the day before Rosh Hashanah, because you want to differentiate between one light type of blows. This is dress down Friday to differentiate. Okay, could very well be. Okay, now then the Kuzri goes to another point which he repeats many, many times, but I want to mention it again, because this question resurfaced hundreds of years later as a major pivotal debate between the Hasidic movement and those who were opposed to the Hasidic movement. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes the point that that although ultimately connection to God depends on the emotions, fear, love, passion, but those emotions must be concretized within meticulous and exact observance of commandments. Now, if you think about this, this position, which is really the classic halachic position, really is the source of tremendous controversy to this very day. And that is always the question. What is more important, the heart or the hand? The feeling or the action? The mitzvah or the intention? You see? Now, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes the point that serving God is not just a matter of spirituality. It's not just a matter of feeling good. It's not just a matter of feeling close. It's also a matter of submission, responsibility, and commitment. And as a result, let's take an example. The Shema of the morning recitation of the Shema is supposed to be recited by the first fourth of the day. 3 hours in the day, right? The first fourth of the daylight hours. Now let's say, this time of year it's approximately shortly after 9 o'clock. So let's say at 9 o'clock Shabbat morning I'm still pretty tired. And I tell them, I say, well listen, the purpose of the Shema is to elevate God and unify God and praise God. And I can't really do it now. My mind isn't very clear. So I'm going to sleep another 3 hours till 12 o'clock. And then I'm going to say the Shema with all of the proper Kavanah. Or let's consider the Pesach Seder, right? You've been working very hard, cleaning up the Pesach. And now tonight is the Seder. And you're just exhausted. You say, this is not a good time for a Seder. Let's go to sleep tonight. Let's go to sleep at 9 o'clock at night. And tomorrow morning we'll be fresh and awake. And we'll have the most wonderful Seder for lunch. Now, it sounds crazy, but if you view mitzvot as simply symbolic expressions of spiritual connectivity or connection, then you might say, who cares if I do it at 9 or 9:10? Who cares if I do it at night or in the day? The main point is, let's make it meaningful, let's make it relevant, let's make it exciting, let's make it passionate. However, what that is ignoring is, that is ignoring the concept of servitude and commitment. That mitzvot are not just, although they have this dimension as well, vehicles to give us good spiritual feelings, but they are also expressions of service and submission to God. And because they are expressions of service to God, they must fall within the rigid limitations of how God defined service, right? If somebody orders, give just a trivial example, if somebody orders a steak in a restaurant and you bring them chili and you say, I think the chili is better. They say, I'm sorry, that's not what I ordered. So a person might say, I think a Seder Pesach morning is nicer. But God's response is, you're doing it for me, not for you. I say it's not that way, right? So this idea of the dichotomy, the tension that exists between what you might call feelings of spirituality and the rigidity and the demands of halacha are a difficult balance that have to be, that constantly create a tension within Judaism. Rabbi Levi says you need to balance it. And just to go back, if I could fast forward a few hundred years in the past of Rabbi Levi, let's go now to the 1700s, the 18th century, when the Baal Shem Tov founded the movement that eventually became known as the Hasidic movement. And of course the Baal Shem Tov did not really establish a mass movement. When the Baal Shem Tov died, there may have been like 50 Hasidim. The Baal Shem Tov was not the great organizer of the movement. The great organizer of the movement was his great disciple, the Magid of Mezerich, the preacher of Mezerich. Dovber was again, I hate using this analogy, but the name that comes to mind is that the Magen Avraham Ezrich had the same role as Paul had in the creation of the Christian church. The real galvanizer of the movement was the Magid of Meserich. His disciple was Lubavitcher Rebbe. And all the different movements came from the Magid of Meserich. But be it as it may, it is well known that the Vilna Gaon, who was the greatest, right, phenomenally greatest Talmudic authority and mystic, he was Kabbalah as well, was adamantly opposed to the Hasidic movement. The Vilna Gaon signed several bans excommunicating the newly created Hasidic movements from Jewish communities. And when the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the author of the Tanya, begged to talk to the Vilna Gaon to try to convince him, the Vilna Gaon refused to see him. Right? The Vilna Gaon's opposition to the Hasidic movement was extremely, extremely powerful. And it was so powerful that he would not even debate or discuss or see anyone. He just said, this is a totally improper thing. Now, what's going on? And we don't fully understand what's going on. But basically, here is the problem. The problem was exactly the problem that Rav Yehuda Halevi was addressing going back to the 11th century, the 1000s. That is, what was the historical genesis of the Hasidic movement? And remember, the Hasidic movement came shortly after the Chelmanitsky massacres of the 1600s, shortly after Shabtai Tzvi, in which thousands of Jews gave up their life savings, thinking there would be a redemption, the false Mashiach. And Shabtai Tzvi was, as you know, was captured by the Ottoman emperor and was forced to convert to Islam. And even then, some Jews continued to believe him. And we have the Frankists. And to this day, they're not really Jews, probably anymore because of intermarriage. But there is a group of people in Turkey. They're now also claiming rights under the law of return to come to Israel. So there's a small group that claim allegiance to Shabtai Tzvi as the Mashiach. I mean, to this day, there are people, and they're claiming that they ought to be recognized as being within the Jewish fold. I think they call it the Dunama, I believe. But be it as it may, the Jewish people, in the aftermath of those tragedies, had a severe sense of malaise. They were, of course, poverty-stricken. They were oppressed with anti-Semitic decrees. But there was also a sense that if you were a common Jew who was not learned, you were not worth very much. You either were learned or you were nothing. There was a sense that in many, of course, not all, but in many circles, the Talmid Chacham would have no connection with the Am HaAretz, with the ignorant person. And the Baal Shem Tov came and taught the idea that one can serve God by their joy in life, one can serve God by their prayer, one can serve God by their loving kindness, that every Jewish soul was infinitely precious and valuable and had a role to play. And as a result, the Baal Shem Tov lifted up the spirits of many, many Jews to show that they too had a connection with God. Now, in a sense, there is no such thing as a truly innovative movement. Because what's the Baal Shem Tov teaching? One can serve God by prayer? Well, I mean, we have plenty of verses in the Bible that say that, right? In other words, everything that is taken from Chumash and from Tanakh and from Gemara and from Medrash. Nothing is new. The newness of all of these approaches is what do you choose to emphasize and highlight. In a tradition in which all of these things are there and present, different times you emphasize different elements because they become dormant and ignored, right? You kind of unearth from the dirt, you unearth the pearls that were hidden for a very long time. So this sounds wonderful, but what was the Vilna Gaon afraid of? The Vilna Gaon saw this as potentially very, very dangerous. Because by emphasizing the primacy of feeling and emotion, he saw this as a potential danger to meticulousness of halachic observance. Because after all, when one begins to have the attitude that how I feel is more significant than what I do, then indeed one might start saying, well, who cares if I say the Shema at 9 o'clock in the morning? Who cares if my Seder is Pesach night? To use a more fancy word, this is called the antinomian tendency of mystical and charismatic movements. Antinomian just means against law. That there is an implicit danger in charismatic, messianic, emotional movements that they will tend to break away from the framework of rigidity and structure, because the whole purpose of these movements is to go beyond structure. The Vilna Gaon said, that might be a wonderful thing, to have fear of God, love of God. The Vilna Gaon certainly had fear of God and love of God. But it must be confined within the halacha. And therefore the Vilna Gaon saw this as a great danger. But in fact, there is a tradition among later Hasidim that it is precisely because of the Vilna Gaon's opposition that the Hasidic movement was pulled back within the fold. Meaning, as you know, now the Hasidic movement are among the most devoutly adhering to the Orthodox tradition. And it is said that had the Vilna Gaon not opposed the original tendencies, it would have broken out. I'll give you an example. We have today what is often called Neo-Hasidism. For example, Zalman Schachter, Shaloni, people like that, people who are involved in Jewish renewal, etc. And again, I'm not going to make any negative statements, but all I want to say is the obvious fact that we do find today that in the neo-revivalist Hasidic movement, there tends to be very little adherence to traditional halacha, precisely because, for the most part, they emphasize the primacy of the spirit. Now, you could say that's good or bad. I'm not even going to express an opinion right now, although I'm obviously not in favor of it. But all I'm saying is, whether it's good or bad, it is objectively the fact that you will find that Jewish renewal is often uncomfortable with structure. I mean, that the nature of Jewish renewal. The Vilna Gaon saw this, therefore, as a danger to the very careful structure of halachic Judaism. And in this, he was anticipating Rav Yehuda Halevi, who writes that in getting involved in one's passionate desire to serve God, one must be ever mindful of the need to look at mitzvot not only as sources of spiritual renewal, but as vehicles of service and submission and commitment to malchut, to the kingship of God. Therefore, don't be carried away, so to speak.
One of my concerns, though, in this pendulum that seems to swing not only in Judaism but also in Christianity, of course, as well, but I'm confronted personally with a very uncomfortable feeling when I'm confronted with the so-called rigidity of halachic observance. When in the pursuit of...
I'm not using it as a negative term.
But because I find that some people, and perhaps they're taught, and somehow I feel that it seems that in the reaction to the fear of having too much spirituality or too much feeling or passion or whatever, the focus is on the rigidity of the halachas before Pesach, for example. How many ounces or milli ounces of the wine is one supposed to drink, or how much of the matzah is one supposed to eat, as opposed to what is the purpose of the Seder, what is the purpose of the wine and the matzah and all the other mitzvot to elevate us, to bring us closer to God, and the fear of the discussion of Tamei mitzvot is one that is brought into this. And I'm concerned that in the schools, that somehow or other that balance is lost.
Yeah, it's a very excellent point. I'll tell you a story that illustrates this so perfectly. You know, the greatest yeshiva in Eastern Europe during the 19th century was the Yeshiva of Volozhin. It was founded by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, who was the Vilna Gaon's disciple. Rav Chaim of Volozhin. So eventually, towards the end of the 19th century, the Volozhin Yeshiva, this is in Lithuania, had two Roshei Yeshivot, had two heads of the Yeshiva. One was a man whose name is abbreviated the Netziv. His name is Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He's very well known. And the other was Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who was the great-grandfather and the namesake of the Rebbe Joseph Soloveitchik, who died in Boston a few years ago. And the Netziv used to say, what is the difference between Rabbi Yasha Ber, that's Rabbi Yosef Dov, and myself? He says, well, let's compare how we feel after a Seder. When I have gone through a Seder, and I've talked about the miracles that God did for Yitzhak Mitzrayim and the plagues and the choosing of the Jewish people, I leave the Seder with a sense of joy and serenity and excitement and passion. And, you know, and to me it's just the greatest, greatest night of the year. For Rav Yosef Dov, he's so worried about the size of the matzah, and did he have enough wine, and after he finishes the Seder, he wonders, did we get rid of everything of chametz? Is there any chametz in the house? Was the matzah not kosher? Because remember, he was afraid that, in fact, they even say that the Yosef Dov Soloveitchik only ate the very minimum of matzah, because he figured, how do I know? If you think about this, the one thing you buy on Pesach that has the greatest chance of being chametz is your matzah. Because your matzah is flour and water. right? The potato things aren't going to become chametz, right? So if matzah is not guarded, matzah becomes chametz. So he was very reluctant to even eat matzah on Pesach because he wasn't sure. Maybe it became chametz. So the Nitziv says he walks away from the Seder feeling miserable because he's worried about so many halachic things that maybe he didn't do that he's losing the joy of the experience. You're 100% correct. We do have a very big problem. And that is the ideal synthesis of emphasizing meaning, of emphasizing purpose, of emphasizing joy, of emphasizing enthusiasm, together with meticulous halachic observance, has tended to become splits, and has become almost, each thing has become almost the exclusive property of one camp or the other camp. That one set of Jewish educational institutions is totally preoccupied with the meticulousness of halachic observance, and the other, let's say Jewish renewal types, talk about meaning, and passion and feeling, but in a context that is devoid of that conscientious application of halacha. When in fact, these are twins separated at birth, so to speak. That there needs to be an integration and a fusion of these two models. Of course, you'll always have the question of time, right? How much can you teach? And then you're going to have to strike a balance in which one gets a little shorter shrift than the other. But you're correct. Tamei mitzvot is a very, very good example. Tamei mitzvot is, what are the spiritual meanings of mitzvot? What are mitzvot supposed to teach us? Very often, we ignore that totally in many curricula in which we basically say, don't ask questions, you know, this is what God decrees. On the other hand, we know that the authentic attitude is that we do know that God's wisdom to some level is beyond our comprehension and we can never give complete explanations. But we are still supposed to endeavor to give some type of meaning that we can understand. Maimonides writes this. Maimonides says that a Jew is obligated to try to identify some spiritual message of every mitzvah, even though we recognize it's not the complete message, but at least a potential message. I'll give you a nice example of this in a minor context, but I think it's a meaningful one. The Chafetz Chaim.
there's a little bit, there's a committee that is there to greet the first man. So the man sees, gee, they're greeting this person, maybe I should ask who I slap. So he asks somebody, can you tell me who that man is? He says, yes, he's the world famous Chafetz Chaim. So the guy is like so embarrassed. He goes over to the Chafetz Chaim and says, you know, Rabbi, please, please forgive me. I mean, I only hit you because I was doing it for your honor. I never would have hit you. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I want to thank you. You taught me an important lesson. My whole life, I taught one should not say bad things about other people. But you taught me I shouldn't say bad things about myself either. And again, the fundamental truth of that is because often our desire to disparage other people is because we feel bad about ourselves. If one understood their own value, there would be no need to cut down other people. Because let that other person be esteemed, because one has their own sense of esteem. It is only when, you know, you feel low that you need to knock down the other guy. But that the story I wanted to tell you is a different story. That is, in the Chafetz Chaim's many trips, he once came to someone's home Friday night, and when he and the husband of the home came home, the husband noticed that his wife, in setting the table, had not covered the chalot, had not covered the bread. You know, Friday night, Shabbat morning, the bread is supposed to be covered. So the man was very embarrassed. For whatever reason, he thought the Chafetz Chaim would figure he didn't know how to set a Jewish table. So he starts yelling at his wife, he says, why didn't you set the table? And the Chafetz Chaim stops him and says, tell me, sir, could you explain to me why the bread is supposed to be covered? And as you know, there are a few reasons. But one of the reasons that's given is that we don't want to humiliate the bread. How is that so? Because normally when you start a meal, you start a meal on hamotzi, bread. The exception to this is Shabbat, we start the meal with a blessing over the wine, the kiddush. The bread may be humiliated because it's relegated to second place. So we cover up the bread so the bread doesn't see what you're doing with the wine. So the man said this, don't embarrass the bread. And the Chafetz Chaim says, I see, sir. So in your concern for not embarrassing the bread, it's okay to embarrass another human being. Now, what is the point of...
That's very Spanish.
Yeah.
Bread doesn't
have any frame. Yeah, well, that's correct. Yeah, in fact, well, so this is what I think the Chafetz Chaim is suggesting. The Chafetz Chaim is suggesting that these types of halachos are primarily symbolic gestures to sensitize us to the importance of respect and dignity. Meaning that if even to the bread I have to behave in a respectful, kind, and considerate manner, even though the bread doesn't feel anything, that should teach me how do I relate to another human being. Meaning, any person who is so fixated on covering the bread that they do so at the expense of humiliating human being, they're going through the mitzvot as mechanical, superficial gestures, and they are not internalizing the meaning of a mitzvah. Meaning, I think that this is a brief for exactly what your position is.
You say that in a pulpit once.
Yeah, right. Well, I said it last week. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Okay.
Well, yeah, you know, that was a way.
I'll have to mark you. I'll mark you absent. Okay.
I was on the mountain.
Okay. But the concept is, you see, the Chafetz Chaim is making the concept that there, even in technical halacha, there has to be the idea of what you would call values education. And I'll be frank, in the Orthodox world in which we intensively learn halacha, we actually pay relatively, I mean, each rabbi is different, each teacher is different, of course, but as a general matter, relatively short shrift is paid to this notion of values. It's treated as too soft. It's not rigid enough. It's not intellectual enough. It's not analytical enough. And as a result, it's often abandoned. But I think that people suffer because of it. People suffer because Judaism then becomes a matter of mechanical observance, a matter of not thinking about what we're doing, a matter of not growing from what we're doing. We just go through various motions. Now, from a Torah perspective, going through the motions is better than not going through the motions, meaning the notion, I can't do these things, so I'll be a hypocrite. We would reject as foreign. Do it even if, you know, you're not growing from it, so to speak. But nevertheless, it's a greatly, greatly diminished, you know, significance. But be it as it may, this pendulum is the source of the original Hasidic Misnagate movement. And it's a tension that exists even within the denominations of Judaism even today, where some emphasize the heart more than the action, etc. So others say the primacy of action. The truth is there needs to be an integration and a synthesis of all of these. So the point is that a lot of these points that Yehuda Levy brings out are, I won't say controversies, because I think in principle everybody admits the synthesis is the correct way, but they are issues that we grapple with in our own lives as to how to do this. And that's why, you know, sometimes a person asks themselves the question, I want to become more religious, more traditional, more observant, so should I incorporate some additional ritual or observance in my life? And that's not always an easy question, because sometimes the incorporation of quantity might be at the expense of a certain amount of reflection. For example, it might be better to pray with fewer words, with more concentration, than to say more words, right? And we always have that question of quantity, quality, act versus intention. These are issues that are very, very major issues.
What was the name of the
Rav Dov Ber. He didn't have a last. In those days, they didn't have last names. I don't know his father's name, but the Maggid of Meserich was Rav Dov Ber.
Of Meserich.
That's what he's called. He's referred to as the Maggid. The Maggid meaning, it's funny, his job was an itinerant preacher, right? He would wander from city to city, although he was crippled, so I don't know how much he did wander. He was on crutches. But he was phenomenal. Here you had a handicapped person who was really one of the phenomenal organizers of a movement which, within 50 years of his death, had more than 1 million adherents. I mean, they really spread. He divided up, he took a map of Europe, and he basically said to different disciples, well, you take Lithuania, you take Galicia, you take Austria, you take Romania, and the founding of the different Hasidic movements, all of which have a different spin, came from the Maggid sending the disciples out. Lubavitch, the author of the Tanya, was one of the younger disciples of the Maggid of Meserich. So it's interesting that the Hasidic movement as a whole only had unitary leadership for two generations. You had the Baal Shem Tov, was the leader of the movement, but it was very small, and the Maggid was the leader, but by the Maggid's death, Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was a disciple, by the Maggid's death you already had the different dynasties being established.
Could it be some of these things, like the covering of the bread, somewhere in Israel?
Yeah.
Had a lot
to fly. Well, I tell you, I don't know if your reason's any better.
You cover the bread until you're ready, and then it became a big decoration. But then let's not, you know.
Well. Another reason that is given is also from last week's parsha, that we have two breads on Shabbat, two loaves of bread, and that's a commemoration of the double portion of the manna that fell on Fridays, and the manna was covered with dew on top and on the bottom. So some say the covering of the bread is a commemoration of the portion of the month.
I was just going to say, in our family, we were never allowed to throw away bread. And we would give it to the birds, something like that, if there was stale bread
right.
left over.
Yeah, that's right. Idea of also showing respect even for the inanimate. And let me give you another text. I'll get to the second. Let me give you another text of gratitude to the inanimate. We see it by the 10 plagues. If you remember the first two plagues, blood and frogs, we are told that Aaron was the one who struck the Nile and turned it into blood, and Aaron struck the Nile and brought out the frogs. Moshe did not create those two plagues. And Rashi says the reason that is so is Moshe could not be an instrument to hurt the Nile, because the Nile had given him shelter when his mother put him. And therefore he owes something. He owes a debt of hakarat hatov, of gratitude to the water. So there is a concept of gratitude even to the earth. Tu B'Shvat, we just had last Shabbat. Tu B'Shvat is also a notion of gratitude to the earth itself for its productivity.
Firstly, isn't there for everyone halachot that can't just make whatever brachot you want in any order. There's a specific order of the brachot you make.
Right.
And usually hamotzi comes primary.
That's right.
And if you're going to change the halacha, so you need to declare a shino, you need some sort of sign that this is not ordinary, but that this is different.
So you're suggesting another reason. You're suggesting that since you are deviating from a halachic protocol, you must show that this is an exceptional case.
Right.
Yeah. Although, again, that's not... I don't know. I mean, the language is, as you know, the embarrassment, Shlo Yira Boshto Shelpa. But you're suggesting that it's not an embarrassment. There. Okay.
And also, Davin HaMelech, when he cut the big day Shaul, so he was punished at the end of his life because the clothing was warm.
Right, that's a very good example. The example that was just said, if you remember when Shaul is persecuting David, and Shaul is asleep, and David comes and cuts Shaul's garment, and then stands on a hill and says, "You see, I was this close to you, I could have killed you," etc. But it's brought down that because David desecrated the garments of Shaul, David was punished that towards the end of his life he was covered with garments, and the garments did not give him warmth. So Chazal say, "Kol ha'mavazeh tabagadim," he who shames or humiliates or defaces garments will not get benefit from them. So if your kids throw their clothes on the floor, just tell them, got to be careful. Yeah. Because you're going to regret this in the future. Yeah. Yeah.
Why was Mishnah able to execute not this with the Aram? Should have gone across the book for the years that he lived in Aram's house as well?
That's an interesting question. Now we would say, well, Paro did not intend to benefit a Jew, but you could say the Nile didn't intend to benefit Moshe either. I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, it could be that I'm not sure how much Paro did for Moshe. I mean, the one who took care of Moshe was Bitya Bas Paro. I don't know if Paro necessarily gets credit. But on the other hand, Paro at least tolerated Moshe there. And I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. Unless we're going to say that whatever good Paro did was more than canceled out by the evil that he did, as opposed to the Nile, which was not an instrument per se of any evil perpetrated on the Jews. But even that is difficult, because that implies the concept that the bad that I do cancels out the good that I do. That's actually not true. In fact, the Torah even says, by Egyptians generally, do not despise an Egyptian. Because you, it's an amazing pasuk. It says, "Do not despise an Egyptian, because you were strangers in their land." Strange idea that somehow I kind of owe them something. At least don't hate them, because they gave me food and water. It was to enslave me. I mean, but you see, even then, there's some type of at least negative hakar. In other words, not to show open animosity.
And the Nile accepted a lot of Jewish babies.
I don't think you consider the water culpable
in
that.
Right. You distinguish between Pharaoh as a human being and Pharaoh as the king and leader of the nation, in which case the plagues were not directed particularly at Pharaoh, but it was for the all of Egypt, and Pharaoh as the leader not his name, whatever his name was personally. Pharaoh is not his name.
In fact, it's interesting that according to rabbinic tradition, again, although it's not recorded, Pharaoh actually survived even the splitting of the Red Sea. Paro was the one survivor, and to be able to tell future generations. So that kind of shows that it wasn't against him. But he was a firstborn, right? He should have died in the plague of the firstborn. And God kept him alive to experience the splitting of the Red Sea. And he even survived that. But be this as I say, this is an issue that all of us do have to grapple with. The issue of how to prevent a rigidity coming into our Judaism where it becomes a matter of rote. And again, once again, this is not new. Go back to the Navi Yeshayahu, who criticized the Jews at the time of the first temple. Mitzvat anashim melumada. One does a mitzvah out of rote, out of habits, mechanically. I mean, this was an old criticism, that the Nevi'im had as well. And then Rav Yehuda Levi goes on, and he gives two examples of the need for meticulous observance. I just want to spend a few moments about this. Now, both of these are male-oriented mitzvot, so I do apologize, but these are the examples that he gives. And he gives the mitzvah of tzitzit, the mitzvah of the fringes, one wears a talit or the like, and the mitzvah of tefillin, the head tefillin and the hand tefillin. The idea of tzitzit, just to go over the basic idea, the Torah says, when you gaze at the tzitzits, the fringes, you remember the mitzvot of God. Now, how do you remember the mitzvot of God? So Rashi gives us a very interesting commentary, meaning in order to remember the mitzvot, you have to have a sense of gematria. Take the word tzitzit, that means fringes. That's tzadik yud, that's 100. Another tzadik yud is 200. And tuf is 400. So the gematria of tzitzit is 400. I'm sorry, 600. 600. And then the tzitzit has eight strings per corner, and five knots. There are five knots. So 8 and 5 is 13. So tzitzit plus 8 plus 5 is 613. So how many mitzvot are there in the Torah? 613. 248 positive, 365 negative, right? 248 thou shalt, and 365 thou shalt not. And therefore tzitzit reminds me of the mitzvot. That's one level. But there's another level too, and that is the way the Torah envisions tzitzit is that there would be a combination of blue and white threads, just like the flag of the State of Israel, which is modeled after that. And that is that some of the tzitzit, it's an argument, is it one out of eight strings? There are different opinions. Two out of eight strings or four out of eight strings? There are different views. Were to be dyed with a special blue dye that's called techelet. And the techelet was a secretion that was obtained from, actually, ironically, a non-kosher, selfish, a mollusk of sorts. And for many, many years, the techelet was lost. We were not sure what the origin was. Now, as you may know, there is a movement to revive the use of techelet. They claim to have identified the mollusk. And there are people that do use techelet. You can buy it. Other people say, we're not sure, or they don't do it. Right? There are different opinions about this. And then, of course, you have the different opinions. How much techelet do you put in the tzitzit? And so you can buy it in three different ways: the one string, and the two strings, and the four strings, etc. But be it as it may, what is the message of the techelet? By the way, the reason techelet got discontinued, in all probability, was because it is a shade called royal blue. And when the Romans ruled over the land of Israel, there was actually a Roman law that anyone that was not of the noble class who would wear royal blue would be executed. It was a capital offense. So it got discontinued not because of a scarcity of the mollusk itself. It probably was never scarce in particular, but simply because it was a matter of life and death, and what eventually happened was the dyeing skill died out. In fact, one of the great modern people who wrote about the reinstitution of techelet was the late Chief Rabbi Herzog, Chaim Herzog, the former president of Israel's father, who wrote a doctoral dissertation, I think at the University of London, on what he called Jewish porphyrology. Porphyrology is the study of fish. And this is his essay on identifying the shellfish of the techelet. But be it as it may, what does the techelet represent? So again, Rashi tells us the following idea, that techelet is supposed to be the color of the ocean, the Mediterranean, the blue Mediterranean. And when I gaze at the techelet, I think of the ocean, or the sea, and the sea reminds me of the blue sky, and the blue sky reminds me of the throne of God that is described as the sapphire throne of God. We don't know what that means exactly, but the Kisei HaKavod of God is represented as Livmat HaSapir, the brick of sapphire, of blue. So therefore, the tzitzit as a whole reminds me of mitzvot, but the techelet of the tzitzit reminds me of God's presence. And it's very interesting. Why does it go through these stages? What does it say? I look at the techelet, so I think of the ocean, and the ocean reminds me of the sky, and the sky reminds me of the divine throne. Why don't you just go to the end point? Why don't you just say, when I look at the techelet, I am reminded of the divine throne. Why do you go through these two intermediate levels? Just skip to the top. So there's a certain allusion in the rabbinic teaching, and that is the notion of gradualism and incrementalism. Meaning, don't think you can go from zero to 140 miles, per hour, in 5 seconds. Rather, one needs to incorporate gradual. You don't go all the way to the top. before you're ready for the Kisei HaKavod, there has to be intervening meditations that one engages in. Now, one final point about this. So again, just basic points here, that the tzitzit, the gematria, is the mitzvot, and the techelet ultimately makes us think of the Kisei HaKavod. But now let's think for a moment about the concept of the fragmentation. Why are some of the tzitzit white and some of the tzitzit blue? Why don't you just have all blue tzitzit, etc.? Why some white, some blue? So here there's an important idea here. That is, blue represents the magnitude of my connection to God, because it reminds me of the Kisei HaKavod. But white is my realization that I'm not there yet. There is still a ways to go. That if a person were to wear only the blue, their heart would be filled with the arrogance of feeling that they have a complete and exclusive relationship with God, when the Jew has to realize that my goal in life is not to arrive, right? Life, as the saying goes, is not a destination, it is a journey. The white represents the journey, the notion that we're not there, that when we think we're there, by definition, we've lost the way, because a person can never think he's arrived. And again, this is a problem that people often have. People often have a sense of complacency in their Judaism. What I am is, or what I was is what I am, and that's it. They say the story with Franz Rosenzweig, a guy I mentioned him earlier, a very, very, very prominent German Jewish philosopher, the first decades of the 20th century. And he and Martin Buber, in fact, translated the entire Hebrew Tanakh, the entire Old Testament, into German. The Buber-Rosenzweig translation is still a very, very highly regarded work. If you're familiar with Nechama Leibowitz, she knows German, she often quotes the Buber-Rosenzweig translation in her own work. But Rosenzweig, towards the end of his life, it's very, very interesting. He became much more involved in traditional Judaism. And there's even a story of how he got involved in the Bible Project. He was a totally assimilated German Jew who entered an academic career in general philosophy, just general philosophy. And in Germany in those days, this was the last decades of the 19th century, if you wanted to be a tenured academic, you officially had to embrace Lutheranism, some form of pride. I mean, you didn't have to go to church at all, but you just had to officially be a member of the church, or you could not get a job. No, so he didn't know anything about Judaism, and he didn't believe in Christianity, but he figured he wanted to get ahead in his career, so he was perfectly happy to become a Lutheran pro forma, just like many Jews in America, unfortunately, just to join a country club would become a Unitarian or some other non-demanding religion. And the story goes that he decided, though, as a philosopher, you know, before I take this step, before I leave Judaism, which I know nothing about, let me just see what it's like to go to a Jewish synagogue. He never went to a Jewish synagogue in his life. So he walks into a synagogue. It happened to be Yom Kippur. He didn't know that. He didn't even know what Yom Kippur was. And he happened to walk into the only Hasidic synagogue in the whole city of Berlin. Berlin was not, as you would expect, a hothouse of Hasidic enthusiasm and charisma. I mean, yeah, Berlin was normally, even the Orthodox in Berlin was kind of a very, very staid, organized type of service. So he walks in, and this blew him over. He sees a room filled with people dressed in white. You know, the men are wearing kippels and talis, and the women are all dressed in white. And people are sobbing and crying and begging God for forgiveness, and people were then singing and dancing with the joy of the end of Yom Kippur and the gift of forgiveness. And he had never experienced this in life. He did not even know it existed. And this created such an internal transformation in him that he resolved that he would be a Jew for the rest of his life. And he abandoned any attempt of the Lutheran pro forma conversion. And that's when he hooked up with Martin Buber, and he got involved eventually in translating the Bible. But he was not what you would call a fully Orthodox, but towards the end of his life, he had authored the Star of Redemption already. Towards the end of his life, he was stricken with multiple sclerosis. And he was getting progressively weaker and losing function in his hands and legs. But he was asked at one point whether he puts on tefillin every day. And his response was, "Not yet. I don't do it yet." And it's been pointed out, it's a very simple response. But there's all the difference in the world between saying not yet and saying no. You could have said no. No would have been an honest answer. But not yet is the recognition that one is a work in progress. You never close the book. Everybody has a not yet in their life. You could be, you know, greatest, most learned, etc. But the not yet, there's something in which one has to be committed to improve. That's life. A perpetual journey to try to make ourselves better. And that's what a not yet is. And not yet, one might suggest, can be the real unifier of every Jew that is serious about spiritual commitment. Regardless of what form it takes, because the not yet is the recognition that we are all trying to grow in our Judaism. And nobody has arrived. Nobody's at the top of the ladder here. There's a ladder. We're all climbing at different paces, but we're climbing it at our own pace. There has to be a commitment to that climbing. And that is the notion, I would suggest, of the blue and the white. The blue is the relationship you've achieved, the Kisei HaKavod. The white is the void, the emptiness, the uncolored part, the part that has not yet been achieved. If a Jew does not have cognizance of the special relationship they do have with God, that's an unfortunate thing. You need that blue to remind us of what we have, the treasure that we have within us. But you need the white to remain humble and to recognize that we haven't completed our mission yet. Okay, so that's the idea of the Tehillim. Yeah.
It's interesting, Korach and his other self, they wanted an egalitarian approach to Judaism.
Right.
They chose as their symbol to dye the entire palace blue.
That's right, that's right. That's exactly right. That when Korach wanted to discredit Moshe, Korach dyed a talit blue and said to Moshe, if a talit is totally blue, is there any reason for the tzitzit? And Moshe said, of course there is. And Korach said, why? If two strings of tchelet are enough, then why should I need tzitzit if the whole thing is tchelet? The way we're explaining it, it's very, very clear that Korach's mistake was the arrogance of saying, we've arrived, we're all holy. We know what to do. We don't need the humility of submitting ourselves to the guidance of a Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the talit that's totally blue. The answer is a talit cannot be totally blue. You got to have the white for the sign of humility. Yeah.
Rabbi Tesler put it a slightly different way to me. He says, yes, we're all here for a purpose, but if you think you've achieved your purpose and you're still alive,
well, that's really right. When a person has achieved their purpose, I mean, that's the blessing. The greatest blessing is that one should die having achieved their purpose in life. I mean, the tragedy is that often people die without having achieved their purpose. But if you've achieved the purpose, there's really no reason to go on living. Unless, by definition, there's some purpose for you that hasn't been achieved yet. I mean, literally, there literally would be no reason to live if there was not a continued purpose to still be achieved. Well, it depends what you mean. The Torah in the book of Numbers does say that when you wear garments, you're supposed to have the tzitzit. That is in the Torah itself, in the book of Bamidbar. However, originally, the talit was not a ritual object per se. Originally, even in the everyday clothing, if you wore like a cloak, it would have the tzitzit. In terms of a ritual object, it probably dates from post temple period. No, I understand this, but you have to understand that when rabbinic literature refers to a talit, it does not necessarily refer to a ritual object that you wear during prayer. It could just refer to the cloak that has to have fringes, a regular coat. So talit does not have a ritual connotation there. It's simply because there's a requirement. Even if you have a poncho, one should know. If you have certain ponchos or square garments that you drape, they have to have tzitzit if they're of certain material. It's not just the religious thing that you wear. Now let me just say a few words about tefillin, which is the second ritual thing that is mentioned. My son had a bar mitzvah recently, so he gave a Dvar Torah on tefillin, so I will plagiarize from him, although he plagiarized from me. But okay. All right. And thank you. The tefillin, if you're familiar with them, are translated by the very unhelpful Greek word phylacteries. I have no idea what phylacteries are, other than they have a translation for tefillin, which I think I know what they are. And if you know, the tefillin, although they're hard, are actually nothing more than leather. They're leather boxes, which are painted black. And in those, and then there are leather straps, and in those leather boxes are parchments, like a mezuzah, like parchments, on which are inscribed verses from the Torah. And the verses that are inscribed from the Torah is the first paragraph of the Shema, Hear, O Israel, God is one. The second paragraph of the Shema, V'hayom Shema, if you keep the commandments. And then two paragraphs from the book of Exodus that talk about Yitziat Mitzrayim, God taking us out of Egypt and redeeming the Jewish people. These are called the four parshiot, the four paragraphs of the Torah and Tefillin. Again, just like a mezuzah, people sometimes make a mistake. People often, when they say mezuzah, they often mean the case. The mezuzah is not the case. The mezuzah is the parchment inside. If you have a beautiful case and there's no parchment inside, or the parchment is Xeroxed, or whatever, you don't have a mezuzah. Conversely, if you have a good parchment, even if you just wrap it in a sandwich bag, you know, a clear plastic bag, that is a valid mezuzah, although it's proper, of course, to beautify the mitzvah, even externally. Tefillin is the same thing. Tefillin is not, although you have to have the kosher boxes, they have to be square and everything, but without the parshiot inside, you don't have tefillin. And that's why it's important that if you buy your child tefillin, they should be opened up by a professional scribe who will check the parshiot to be sure that they're good. Because keep in mind, for mezuzot and tefillin, even if a parsha was good to begin with, things can happen. For example, letters can crack, particularly when the parchment is folded. Letters can jump off the page, because ink, if you ever look the way, the ink is like on top of the, it's like floating on the parchment, so it can actually leave the parchment, can fly away. So mezuzot and tefillin have to be checked with some regularity. But be it as it may, we have the two tefillin. We have tefillin of the hand and tefillin of the head. Now, here, the idea is this very, very beautiful idea. The head is, of course, the seat of intellect, the mind. The hand is the instrument of physical action. And, of course, tefillin are supposed to be put on the left hand, which is adjacent to the heart. Although in the case of a lefty, we have a problem. I'll get to that. But let's just assume the standard lefty. The standard person whose dominant hand is the right hand puts the tefillin on in the left hand. Consequently, the hand has two distinct symbols. It is the symbol of action, but it's also the symbol of heart and emotion. So essentially, what tefillin is are, you're taking the word of God, and you want it to penetrate your mind and your intellect. You want it to penetrate your emotions and your feelings. And you're committing your hand, your action, and your physical strength. So one starts off the day with a commitment of action, emotion, and intellect to the will of God. And in a very literal sense, you know the way kids sometimes put a book under their pillow, they have to do homework, and they say, you know, maybe the book will osmosis. Go into my head, osmosis, in that way. Right. Well, tefillin is indeed described as a source of spiritual osmosis, where the words go into the brain, go into the heart, and energize the hand. You see? I mean, that's what it is. Now, what's very interesting is, in the order of tefillin, the hand tefillin is put on before the head tefillin. First you put on the hand, then you put on the head. And that connotes the idea, once again, that even if one's understanding does not perceive God's mitzvot, one commits them. That's na'aseh v'nishma. We do, even if we don't fully understand. In other words, one does not say, my obedience is conditional on my understanding. Rather, the deed must come even before the understanding. At that state, we have na'aseh v'nishma. The Jews said of Matan Torah, we will do and we will hear. Now, I don't want to get into political issues. Let me just mention very, very quickly that it is true that these two examples of tzitzit and tefillin are classified halachically as mitzvot that are mandatory only for men and not for women. The mandatory, the technical reason for that is there is a rule in halacha which has many, many exceptions. It actually has many more exceptions than the rule that says mitzvot asay shehazman grama. That means what? Positive commandments which are time based. They can only be done at a certain time. They can't be done all the time. Women are technically exempt from. Tzitzit is a time-based commandment. Why? Because we don't wear tzitzit at night. We only wear tzitzit during the day. Tfilin is also a time-bound commandment, both because we don't wear tfilin at night, and we don't wear tfilin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So the technical reason why women are exempt is based on this principle of mitzvat asay, shazman grama. Now I just want to mention there are many, many exceptions to this rule. For example, women have to eat matzah Pesach night, they have to drink 4 cups of wine, they have to light Hanukkah candles, they have to read Megillat Esther, they have to recite Kiddush. All of those are time-bound commandments, but there are exceptions to the rule. There are so many exceptions, which are actually more than the rule, but there is still this rule unless we have special exceptions. Now, the big question, again, because I don't want to be political, I just want to throw it out, the big question is this. Normally, the rule of mitzvat asei shazman grama simply says women are not obligated, but they are permitted if they so desire. Example, lulav and etrog, or even shofar and Rosh Hashanah. Women are exempt from hearing the shofar and Rosh Hashanah because it's time-bound. Women are exempt from eating in a sukkah because it's time-bound. Women are exempt from taking lulav and etrog because it's time-bound, right? That's also true. And yet, among Ashkenazim at least, it is understood that the fact that women are exempt doesn't stop them from doing it if they so desire. And that's why women go to shofar blowing, women take lulav and etrog and even make a blessing, and women sit in the sukkah, right? That's clear. So the $64,000 question, well, I guess now we just scolded them, the $1 million question, therefore, within classic halachic Judaism, could a woman basically say in a synagogue, I want to voluntarily put on a talit, or even more dramatically, I want to voluntarily put on tefillin. Now again, I want to be very clear. If the question is it a mandatory thing for a woman to do, there's no question it's not mandatory based on the classic rule of Zman Grama. The question is it an optional thing? So logic would have indicated, well, if sukkah is optional and lulav is optional, and shofar is optional and even encouraged, why not this? So here we do get into different views. I mean, you have to talk to your individual rabbi over this. It is recorded in rabbinic tradition that Michal, the daughter of Shaul HaMelech, actually wore tefillin every day. On the other hand, the Gemara is very, very obscure as to whether this is a positive thing or a negative thing, because Michal Bat Shaul, in many ways, is not regarded as a role model. Remember, Michal Bat Shaul was the one that when David is dancing, when the Ark is brought to Jerusalem, Michal, his wife, says, what are you doing? And David says, for God, you do this. And the Pasuk says, Michal Bat Shaul died without ever having a child. Yeah, and so it's not good. The Gemara is very unclear. It throws this out, but it doesn't say anything good, and it doesn't say anything bad. So it's not clear what the lesson is. There's another tradition, I'm not sure if it's substantiated, that the great Rashi, who only had daughters. Rashi did not have any sons, but Rashi's daughters not only wrote Talmud commentaries, but Rashi's daughters also wore tefillin. So there is some precedent for it. On the other hand, it is, for various other reasons, it's also discouraged. So basically, you know, I'm not giving any psak halacha. I just want you to have the information so that if it's a live issue for anybody, they should be able to discuss it with whoever they discuss it with. Yeah.
I recently was in the Shrine of the Book in Yerushalayim, which I've been to many times before. But this time, I happened to notice the exhibition of the tefillin from the time of Eretz Yisrael.
Wow.
And they were so tiny. They're not the kind that we have. They were all in microscript. And maybe the tefillin of the head was not even the size of the thumb, not even the size of the hand. So when you read that people wear tefillin all day long, you wonder how they're wearing these big boxes.
Right.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. The original mitzvah of tefillin was to wear tefillin the entire day, except when we went to the bathroom or the like. And they actually were small little things. Small tefillin have an advantage and a disadvantage. Small tefillin have a disadvantage because it is much more difficult to write. Same thing with a small mezuzah. It's much more difficult to write a kosher parchment when it's tiny than when you have plenty of room. The advantage is that halacha is very meticulous about the proper placement of the head tefillin. It can't go too low and too high. And if it's big, especially in a bar mitzvah boy, right? A little 13-year-old wears these gigantic things. And the whole, you know, the hand tefillin is not in the right place, and the head tefillin is not in the right place. So through the smaller tefillin, are actually much better for accurate placement. But be it as it may, the point I wanted to bring out once again is that tefillin, in the classical sense, is the notion of binding oneself to God by the three faculties of the human soul: the mind, the heart, and the action. And the action has a primacy over the mind and the heart, simply because it is the action that gives rise to the thought, rather than the thought giving rise to the action. That's a very important principle that the Kuzari himself said many, many times. Meaning, sometimes we feel, I'm not going to act good until I feel good. Tefillin says, no, first you act, and then you feel. Right? This is a very helpful thought, even in marriage counseling. Right? Let's assume somebody says, I don't feel very loving towards my spouse. They don't express affection to me. I don't feel like being a nice person to them. Well, what a counselor might say is, make believe you felt it. Do it anyway. Right? That's nasa. And then, you know, by doing it, there might be transformations. And that's the primacy of action that is in the tefillin.
Break it till you make it.
Say again?
Break it till you make it.
That's right. That's exactly it. So the tefillin is a lesson
no,
for...
That is a
lesson for that. So... So it's interesting, though, that when the Kuzari wants to give us an example of the importance of meticulous and exact observance, he picks tzitzit and tefillin. And I think the reason he picks it is very simple. Because tzitzit and tefillin are symbolic. They're designed to remind us of things. They're designed to sensitize us to things. They're like a string around the finger. So one might have made the argument, well, if they are simply instrumental in raising consciousness, then, like, what's the big difference if I follow all of the rules or rituals? It's just a string around my finger. So he's making the point that even when something is simply a string around the finger, God describes the way the string has to work. Meaning, even those mitzvot, which are really nothing more than reminding you of your ultimate destiny, you have to follow the parameters of the divine. I guess, and how much more so for the other mitzvot?
Is there another reason other than proximity to the heart, why the left hand is used? Because you think, If you're going to commit it to action, then you should be
advocating. Right, so here's the big question. The big question is the following. Everybody says, the standard explanation is, the reason we put tefillin on the left arm is because the left arm is adjacent to the heart, and therefore it's connected to emotion. So here's the problem. Let's assume that somebody is a lefty. Their dominant hand is a left. They actually put tefillin on their right arm. Meaning you put tefillin on your weaker arm, not your left arm. Now, I assume lefties have their hearts on the left. I guess. So that undermines the explanation that it's because of the heart. Meaning there's some significance of the weaker hand. And that seems to be the notion, once again, a lesson in humility, that one recognizes that without binding my action to God, I am a weak and helpless person. Therefore, it's connected to that notion of submission. Although there is a machloket, there are some opinions that do say tefillin is always on the left hand, regardless. But we don't rule that way. We rule that it's on the weaker hand. Yeah, well, that's correct.
There are those that learn to be in order to wear tefillin on the left hand.
Yes, but that's because of the uncertainty. Because of that machloket, because of that machloket. Yeah. But according to our strict halacha, if you are a bona fide lefty, you put tefillin on the right.
I'm curious about this thing of Malvin Kodesh Avinu Choshech. Right. Chazal said that Avraham Avinu did some sort of tefillin, and you find that Yaakov Avinu did with the sticks, he carved out white on black.
So it resembles the tefillin.
And we say that Kodesh Baruch Hu does tefillin, but not exactly tefillin.
Yeah, that's another amazing Gemara. The Gemara says that God wears tefillin. God puts on the tefillin every day. And the Gemara even asks, what is contained in God's tefillin? So if in our tefillin we have verses that proclaim the glory of Hashem, in Hashem's tefillin there are verses that proclaim the glory of His people, the Jewish people. If you remember the hymn of glory, Anim Zemirot, so it says, Pe'eiro Alai, U'Pe'eiri Alav. Pe'eiro Alai means, His glory is upon me, meaning, I wear God's glory. U'Pe'eiri, and my glory, Alav, is upon God. In fact, they have the story of the Berditchev Rebbe, or Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, the great Hasidic leader, who always tried to find good things about the Jewish people. He once complained, you know, he always would argue with Hashem about different things. So he once argued with Hashem, you know, if a Jew drops their tefillin, they kiss it and they fast and they take care of it, and we're your tefillin, and we're dropped and trampled all over the world, why don't you pick us up and kiss us and, you know, take care of us? But what does it mean that God wears tefillin? Again, I mean, we don't understand this. Obviously, it's not literal, it's not leather. But it means that just as our tefillin are designed to give us an awareness, a cognizance of the divine, so too God is always thinking about the Jewish people. There's that connection. But yeah, tefillin is a big thing, and more than once, I mean, more than one person has been brought to Judaism simply by putting on tefillin. I mean, putting on tefillin and taking them off does have an effect on it. On a person in many ways.
Doing the Ben Gurion Airport.
That's right.
As you walk by, right. They'll just
Chabad has many many.
And they'll
tefillin,
just put the
right.
tefillin on, and that's some right. of the people don't even. Right. They may not have done it for many years before.
Or ever.
And they just say, right. "Come on, you know, put
just
on
put it on, put it on, and take it off." Yeah.
And they're there. I didn't know about New York, but I've seen it.
I've seen it in Ben Gurion, but I've seen it in many places,
many
places, and even the United States, New York.
It's so intimate. Just think what you're saying while you're saying the same things you say at your wedding.
That's correct. In fact, you know, the tefillin is also wrapped seven straps around the arm. Seven straps. And, you know, the custom is a bride walks around a chatan seven times. And this corresponds to the wedding vows that Hosea, the Navi Hosea, talked about God, as it were, betrothing the Jewish people. They rastach li li'olam, I will betroth you unto me forever. They rastach li b'tzedek v'mishpat v'chesed v'rachamim, I will betroth you unto me with righteousness and justice and loving kindness and mercy. That's four. They rastach li b'emunah, I will betroth you to me with faith. V'yadat es Hashem, and you will know Hashem. That's seven expressions of endearment, the seven straps, a chatan and a kalah, making those commitments to each other. Right, so it's all connected in that way. So it's a special thing, and as I say, the Kuzari makes a point about the many many halachot that still have to be connected to this particular mitzvah. Okay, maybe we'll stop here, and Mr. Shai, I guess we're on next week.
Yeah,
remember, it's always going to be Thursday. Okay,
now you want also that Thursday to be skipped?
Yeah, I think so.